Morning, Council. Next and final case on our oral calendar for today is A19-0204, State of Minnesota versus Sophia Wang Navas. Council, both of you are familiar with our procedures, 15 minutes each, 5 minutes for rebuttal. State your name for the record when you approach the podium and the party you're representing. Council for appellant, feel free to take your time to get settled in, but whenever you're ready, you may proceed.
So if it may please the court, counsel, my name is Charles Clippard. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Ms. Sophia Wang Navas. Ms. Wang Navas was convicted in a sex trafficking conspiracy case that was prosecuted out of Washington County. She was one of four co-defendants, and all the cases resolved in a guilty plea, but it might be helpful just to establish the cast of characters we're dealing with. So my client pled guilty to a RICO violation and a second-degree sex trafficking. Her presumptive sentence was in the range of 74 to 103 months, but she was given an aggravated durational departure up to 150 months. The first person, I think, who was arrested was Mr. Dong Zhou Jiang. I think based on the recitation of facts from the prosecutor's brief, he seemed to be the guy on the ground that was doing a lot of the work here in Minnesota about setting up the houses where the sex acts would be coordinating with the prostitutes. It seemed like perhaps he had a greater role in this enterprise than my client. But he agreed to a sentence with a level 8 offense because the RICO offense is not ranked. So part of this whole equation is ranking the offenses and then determining the appropriate sentences. And he received an 83-month executed sentence. Third co-defendant is Ms. Hong Jing. And she agreed to a plea agreement with a level 9 of ranking of the offense and 102 months. And the fourth co-defendant was Ms. Fang Yao Wu, who was also came to an agreement in her case. Her agreement was for a 36-month sentence that was stayed, and she was ordered to serve 5 days with credit for 5 days. So the range of sentences we have is Ms. Wu, who was served 5 days of incarceration, to my client, who's serving 150 months. And
right, but she was described as one of the, quote, boss ladies, correct?
She was described by one of the co-defendants, Mr. Zhang. But I think it's important when the court was balancing or weighing where to rank the offenses, she noted that my client and Ms. Jing had actually very similar roles and similar culpability. And so I think my client's behavior is more in line with Ms. Jing rather than Mr. Zhang. And again, that was based on the court's determination at when they were ranking the offenses. So I think there's a couple of issues that kind of come into play here, and I've tried to conceptualize them and keep them separate. But it seems that the first step here is you have to rank the offense based on the objective criteria to define the appropriate guidelines. And it seems like the court was not doing that, but actually considering the offense conduct of each individual to rank the offenses. And I admittedly didn't challenge the rank of the RICO offense in my brief. I absolutely admit that, because I don't think that given the discretion of the court in ranking an offense, I could come up with an abuse of discretion.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but the way I read it, there were the primary issue is how do you treat multiple victims and when is that important in this process? It looked like there were multiple places. One of them is in ranking.
Correct.
And there's lots of cases that say you can't use the same multiple victims as a basis for ranking or establishing a severity level, and then also as an aggravated factor. So that's part one. The second step might be when you're talking about use of multiple victims, and is it an element of the predicate offense? And then also, is racketeering necessarily require multiple victims or not? So you've got this multiple victims piece coming in as an aggravating factor, but also potentially as you're addressing the predicate offense, the racketeering offense, and his ranking. So why don't we start with the ranking piece? Because
right.
I do think you raised that
yes,
the court was wrong to use multiple victims both as a basis to rank and then later on as an aggravating factor. So the question I have for you is, what do you think the court looked to in ranking the severity level in this case, and how important was multiple victims to that analysis?
So the ranking occurred on October 23rd, and I think it's at transcript page 25. And the court said the racketeering occurred in multiple counties. And again, in my reply brief, I concede that she did not say, I find there were multiple victims. But based on the facts she found to rank it, there's no way that this thing occurs without multiple victims. That was my point.
Right, but that approach really has an inference. It's not, as you acknowledge, the district court never explicitly said there are multiple victims involved, therefore I'm using that as a calculation in determining what the ranking would be for this and
right.
getting to but number nine.
I think it's a very strong inference. You can't, again, the factors she cites are the offense occurred for a better part of a year. That has to necessarily involve multiple victims.
What it necessarily? Could you have just one victim that is, and in fact, one victim did was transported from one place to another. I don't know if that's an inference that we can reasonably.
I think if you look at all the facts that she relied upon, if you maybe look at them each individually, then. I absolutely see your point, and I was struggling when I wrote this brief to say, can you have a RICO violation on a sex trafficking case with only one victim? I think in theory, conceptually, you could. You could have four or five people.
Well, let's start with the ranking piece, because
okay.
I think that's a valid question at each of the stages. Right.
Yes.
One of them it's answered because the statute includes just the term an individual when you're looking at the predicate offense, but in terms of the racketeering, that's a great question that I hope we can address. But in terms of ranking, I have the same question that Judge Reyes did. Does it necessarily require multiple victims?
And no. And as to the sex trafficking?
The facts, I should be more precise. The facts or the reasoning that the district court provided in its ranking decision, does that necessarily require it?
Yes. The facts as found by the district court to rank it, again, consumed a better part of the year, which again leads to the inference that it's multiple victims. Racketeering occurred at a sustained level of activity, which again infers this happened involving multiple victims. The fact that there were happening in different counties and multiple locations, again, infers or requires that there be multiple victims.
I don't know if it, I think inferences as far as you can really go. I don't think it actually requires it, and I think at least some of the facts actually lean towards the other way of the possibility that it could just be one victim that's transported all over.
Right. But we know in the facts of this case that's not what happened, because we know based on some of the arrests that they would come in and they would see multiple people in multiple locations, you know, with a setup to traffic.
Well, let's, for purposes of applying kind of the rule or asking us to define a rule when it comes to ranking, and even assuming that the district court had said, one of the factors I'm considering in terms of ranking is how many victims there are, as well as six or seven other different factors, and is it, in your view, an error to include it as a factor as opposed to like the factor or the primary factor?
In the ranking?
Yes.
Well, I think if the court were going to rank, it's not an error for the court to use multiple victims as a factor to rank. It's that you cannot then go back and use that as a departure ground. And again, I think the court found there were six, maybe seven victims in this case. So there is an explicit finding that there were multiple victims involved in this specific.
Right, but the question is, where did the district court use the multiple victims? Did it use it in the ranking? Did it use it in the departure? Did it use it in both? Where did it use it? And it seems like the district court's language for ranking does not explicitly call out the multiple victims as a factor.
And I guess
part of the calculus.
I guess we're going to maybe not agree on this, because I think when you look at the facts that she pointed out, multiple counties, multiple locations, long period of time, sustained activity, all of that requires multiple victims.
So I guess I'm asking these questions because I see a lot of times there's overlap between the reasons for a judge to sentence somebody within the range, the reason to depart upward, and the basis for establishing a number for purposes of severity level. a lot of times you look to the same facts and you're going to make the same list of reasons. So if we're today applying Kennard or some of these other cases about relying on something in both to rank and then later as an upward departure, it makes it a little difficult to ever contemplate an upward departure if you have an unranked offense, because you have to look to something and have some reasons before it, and whatever reasons you pick are going to overlap with some other basis for a departure.
I don't agree. I think you could have held a departure here based on the victims being particularly vulnerable because they were brought into the country, didn't speak English, were taking their passports away, so essentially they were under the a significant amount of control of the people who are running this organization. Now, that would have been a cleaner way, I think, to do the departure. And that, again, doesn't get into the number of victims, but it gets into the who they're bringing in. And again, by saying that they're particularly vulnerable based on their circumstances would be inadequate and would have been a better ground for departure here in this case. So I don't necessarily agree that you can, that having to rank of an offense automatically precludes departure grounds. And I think that's what Kennard says as well. So you still have to look at the circumstances to see whether there's a departure. And the other hard part about this is, in my 25 years as a criminal defense lawyer, this is the first RICO case I've ever put my hands on.
So why don't we address that, the requirements for RICO, and whether or not, the question you asked yourself a minute ago, whether or not the RICO elements requiring a pattern necessarily require multiple victims.
And I think in theory you could construct an organization or a sex trafficking incident where the organization is top heavy. It's four people to do whatever however their enterprise is set up, and have one victim who's the person that's being sex trafficked. It's a little bit weird because on the Kelly case that I cite in my reply brief, there was a guy, just a single guy, who was driving, I think, successive girlfriends around and sex trafficking them for money. And the Supreme Court said, that's not enough. You got to have something more. And I think I'm going to butcher the name of the case. It's H-U-Y-N-H. Quinn notes that a RICO case has got to be something significant. Otherwise, it implodes on, it makes any offense just a RICO offense. So I think the Nguyen case would seem to suggest it's got to be something more than just a normal run-of-the-mill crime. And what I don't have, I think a cleaner case or way to do this would have been to say the typical RICO case in sex trafficking involves four victims. I'm just pulling a number out just to, so that there's numbers to talk about. This case is worse than the normal RICO sex trafficking case because we have 6 to 7 victims. And I don't know if that's maybe not the best example, because I don't know if they're 2 victims or 3 victims more makes it particularly more serious, warranting a departure. But I think that's what you've got to do. You've got to establish the base and determine whether this is worse than the typical RICO base. And I think Mr. Hajdukovic and I both point out that, or at least when I was looking at the RICO statute, there are so many predicate offenses on a RICO that there's no, it's hard for, at least for me, to figure out this is the typical RICO sex trafficking case, and this is worse because of the number of victims. And I think that's, again, that may have been a cleaner way to do the departure. This was more serious than the typical because you'd have to come up with the victims here were greater than 7, and that may have been a better departure ground, because again, that would distinguish between the typical RICO in this case. And finally, I do have to talk about the sentencing disparity, because it just goes again back to the ranking. The ranking was almost used to accommodate the sentencing disparity, the especially with Ms. Wu, where they ranked it as a level 7, and I guess even Mr. Jiang got a level 8. And again, when they noted the ranking, when they were doing the ranking hearing on my client's case, they were saying it makes no sense to rank these The RICO case is the same level as the sex trafficking. But the judge did it on two of the co-defendants and then used those rankings to adjust the sentences. And I guess from on the same probable cause statement on four co-defendants to get a disparity from 5 days to 150 months executed is, I guess it's pretty staggering. And I think to say, oh, well, this person was just laundering the money, there would have been one real quick way to shut this thing down would be to for her to stop laundering the money, and this whole organization would have just stopped. So what I'm asking this court to do is find that the departure grounds are not valid in this case and to remand for imposition of a guideline sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent.
Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Nick Hajdukovic, and I'm an assistant Washington County attorney, and I represent respondent State of Minnesota. The state is asking this court to affirm the 47-month upward departure from the top of the presumptive range in this case because, first of all, the judge did rely on agreed-upon and valid grounds for an upward departure, and secondly, because it is not so disproportionate to the sentences received by the co-defendants that this court must reverse it. Now, I'll start. My plan was to go through the argument, barring questions, of course, in the same order as counsel did because I think it might be of assistance to the court. The question was raised, where did the court rely on multiple victims, on the existence of multiple victims in its ranking of the racketeering offense? And I think the answer is it didn't. Now, I think Mr. Clipper can correct me if I'm wrong, but as I interpret his argument, he's pointing out things like that the district court sometimes used terms in its analysis like women or victims in the plural sense. I think what the district court was doing there was not relying on the number, but simply talking about the facts of the case. And the facts were that there were more than one victim. There was more than one woman involved as a victim in the case. So my interpretation of that analysis in the ranking is not relying on the number of victims so much as it is when describing what was going on, simply describing it that way because that was the fact. Those were the facts of the case, the multiple number, not relying on the multiple number.
Would it be possible for the district court to have relied on those same facts about occurring over multiple days, multiple counties, vulnerability, without necessarily referring to multiple victims as it did by using the plural, victims instead of victim?
Sure. I mean, I think the district court could have worded it differently and come to the, and essentially done, in essence, the same analysis and arrived at the same conclusion as to the seriousness of the crime and the proper severity level at which to rank the crime. The district court didn't, but I think that the way that question is helpfully phrased, I think, sort of demonstrates my point, which is that it was more of a matter of what terminology the district court chose to use. It was descriptive of the facts of the case, but not necessarily relying on the existence of the multiple victims.
Again, I guess I'm asking these questions because I want to make sure it's clear, whatever this opinion looks like, that the district court judges in the future, when they're faced with an unranked offense, understand what they can and can't say in order to determine a ranking at the same time that they might be having to rule on a departure motion.
Sure, and I think that is a very appropriate consideration. What I would suggest is, and I want to back up a little bit before directly answering that question so I'm not perceived to make any concessions I don't intend to make, that I'm not conceding that post-Fleming and post-enactment of Minnesota Statute 244.10 Subdivision 5A paren B, which I cite in my brief, that the district court is precluded from relying on similar or same facts for both ranking and a durational departure. But assuming the court does believe that to still be good law, then what I would note is that I think the court could simply indicate that in the future going forward, district courts should be very careful to enumerate precisely what they are and are not relying upon in their ranking decision if they are, particularly if there is going to be a ranking of the offense and a possible departure from a presumptive sentence. I think that would be appropriate for the court to say, because I will admit that I think it could have been stated more clearly by the district court judge had she been thinking about it in those terms. I suspect she was not thinking about it in the way we're thinking about it today, and I think that's probably in large part because there was an agreement not to an upward departure, but there was an agreement that the state could seek an upward departure, that the court could, if it chose, impose an upward departure, and that the appellant had admitted facts that would support such a departure. So what I suspect is the district court wasn't thinking along these lines when she was setting forth her analysis. But I do think going forward that is something appropriate to consider so that we do have as clean of a record for appellate purposes as we can get. I would agree that's appropriate. One thing I did want to note from the Kennard case, by the way, regarding the reliance, what the court can rely on. In footnote 3 in that case, the court notes that by specific conduct, we mean that conduct underlying proof of the elements, Well, we have held that such conduct cannot be relied on to justify an upward departure. There's a citation. We conclude that it is appropriate for setting the severity level for unranked offenses. And then the court goes on to say that once the courts determine the severity level by considering the conduct underlying proof, it is not prohibited from considering whether there are also aggravating or mitigating circumstances. I read that, I think it's important to read that if the court is concerned about this issue in light of the law that has come since, the Fleming case and the statutory changes regarding aggravating factors. Because what as I read the Fleming case and the statute that underlies that case, what it says is that a district court can consider any underlying factors that are relevant, essentially, even if they are maybe relevant to elements of the charged offense or another charged offense in determining whether an upward departure is appropriate. So as I read that case, the Fleming case, as well as the statute that it relies upon, I read that case as broadening the array of facts that a district court can rely on when imposing an upward departure. Now, what I would also note is that, as the court also noted, I think, during appellant's argument, with regard to the ranking of the offense, there were other factors that were discussed outside of just the victims themselves. There was discussion of the characteristics of the victims, as I think I phrased it in my brief, but also the amount of time that the racketeering went on, and then the other factors as well, which aren't directly related to any characteristics or number of victims, regarding comparison of the ranking to the underlying ranking of the sex trafficking charge, as well as comparing it to another sex trafficking and racketeering case that the same judge had presided over previously. Now, I would also note, I guess this may move to the disproportionality argument that counsel made, that I would agree with Mr. Klippert that there isn't necessarily a clear baseline for what makes a racketeering case with an underlying predicate felony of sex trafficking, what that typical case looks like. I think those cases are just now in recent years much more broadly prosecuted and recognized for the problem that they are. But what I don't think the sentencing guidelines intend for is for, because this is an early case, to mean that an upward departure could not be imposed. I agree that it's somewhat difficult to say.
Isn't it a challenge when you first start with the initial case or two of trying to say this is more egregious than a typical case when you don't have a baseline for which to make that comparison?
It does pose some problems, and that's long been a criticism I've had of that whole framework. Because what if the first case that ever arises is the worst one that ever arises? I'm not suggesting that's necessarily the case here, but it could certainly conceptually happen. There's no authority, first of all, that says that, and I think the best we can do is to compare it to other racketeering cases and perhaps other sex trafficking cases. And I haven't seen anything indicating generally that this is disproportionate. I know Mr. Clippard in his addendum to his brief cited some information from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission that he obtained about sentencing and racketeering cases, but as we agree, that statute encompasses such a vast array of conduct that I don't know that the data we have really tells us anything. And another way to look at it, and this is admittedly somewhat outside the framework of comparison to the typical offense, is that essentially what Judge Miles did in this case, it seems in some sense, was to look at the facts of this case and say, these are so egregious that, simply put, what the guidelines provide for presumptively does not encompass the level of harm done to society and what justice would demand in a case like this. And determined that it is so heinous, and it is more heinous than the typical offense, whatever that might be, because we can't imagine something a lot more heinous, perhaps, is one way to look at it, that this sentence is the proper one and that an upward departure should be granted.
What would have been cleaner is Mr. Clippard argued to have a different reason for to justify the upward departure rather than just multiple victims?
I think it probably would have made the analysis here easier. I don't dispute that. But
because isn't multiple victims, it seems to be inherent in the facts here and the elements of the crime.
Well, I disagree that it's an element of the crime, because I think you could absolutely prosecute a racketeering case involving sex trafficking with one victim. If there was an enterprise trafficking one
you could, person. But that's not the case here.
No, I agree. That's not the case here. But my point is it's just not an element of the crime, though. Part of the issue I think that we have in this case is that it was done as part of a plea agreement. And standing here, I wasn't the prosecutor at trial. I do not know, I guess, whether this particular fact was agreed upon as the possible basis for departure, because it was something that maybe it was the only thing that the defendant would admit to in a plea hearing. But it was part of a plea agreement that the defendant would admit to the existence of multiple victims, as she did, and also then that the state could seek, based on that, an upward departure. And I realize that the law in Minnesota allows for a defendant to challenge even an agreed-upon sentence in some circumstances, but...
Well, it wasn't clear that they were contemplating a departure based on multiple victims.
Well, as I read the
it was kind of a generic upward departure motion that's contemplated.
Right.
It's not tied to any one specific fact admitted at the plea.
The prosecutors in the case filed relatively early on, I believe, a very lengthy notice of their intent to rely on various aggravating factors to obtain an upward departure if the matter proceeded to trial. And it was a long list of factors. At the plea hearing, as I read the prosecutor's language, this is on page 4 of the plea transcript, the parties agreed that the conduct involved the sex trafficking of multiple females across the state of Minnesota. And then in the departure report and on the record as well, the Judge Miles said the departure was based upon the heinousness of the offense as measured in the number of victims who were involved. And actually, I think there might even be a little bit more language than that in the departure report. That was directly from the sentencing transcript at page 40. So there were multiple possible aggravating factors in this case. But the way the plea agreement was worded, the defendant only admitted to that one specific aggravating factor of multiple victims. But the point I'm trying to make is that I would agree that it would have been easier for us to analyze this had it been something completely independent and completely different from the sort of underlying facts of the case. But that is the plea agreement that it was reached, and it was an agreement made by the defendant in the case. And now as we stand here, the defendant is essentially trying to say, I know I agreed you could use this, but you couldn't really use it, so now I get a presumptive sentence. And obviously the state disagrees with that as well.
If it was used in ranking and only in ranking, then that wouldn't be inconsistent, or would it, in your view, with the plea agreement?
If it was used only in ranking and, well, I would assume that means there wasn't an upward departure.
Or the upward departure is based on some other...
If the defendant had admitted to a different factor that could give rise to an upward departure, yes, I think then it yeah, I think we'd have no issues whatsoever in that situation. I do want to address briefly the remedy issue in the event that the court does rule that the departure was not justified here. The state's position is that the defendant is definitely not entitled to simply have the case remanded for imposition of a guideline sentence. And the Supreme Court's decision in Lewis, which I cited in my brief, that was a case, I believe, where the plea agreement called for a departure, and then the Supreme Court in the, I don't know how to say the name, Misquitas case, said that you can't base an upward departure solely on a plea agreement. There have to be other reasons as well. And this case was still pending at that time, and so it was remanded, and part of the issue was what's the proper scope of the remand. And basically what the Supreme Court said is that we hold that where the district court finds, and this was a case where there were no substantial or compelling circumstances, it was just a plea agreement, that the court could consider a motion to vacate the conviction and the plea agreement. And so the state is asking that if this court does remand, that the scope of that remand allow for the district court to do that should the state make that motion. I'm out of time. I thank the court.
Thank you, counsel.
Just the issue on remand, Your Honor. I think Lewis was a pretty distinguishable case in what's before the court. Lewis, I think, they pled for a specific number, and they based the number on the plea agreement. So when there was an appropriate basis for the plea agreement, the sentence blew up there. Here, the plea agreement provides for a broad range of possible consequences, from possibly probation to a executed sentence of 150 months. And so if the district court had granted my client probation, the government couldn't come up and appeal because that was a sentence that was contemplated by the parties at sentencing. So I don't think Lewis is controlling here, and I don't think the appropriate remedy on remand would be to blow this thing back up. I think the appropriate remedy is to say the departure grounds were not appropriate, and because of that, because of Hicks, when the departure grounds are not appropriate, the remedy is imposition of a guideline sentence. So that's what we'd be asking the court to do. Thank you.
Well, I have a couple of follow-ups if you
sure.
Can stick around for a little longer. The first question is, do you agree with the characterization of the plea agreement that it was contemplated an upward departure that's tied to multiple victims?
Yes. The plea agreement, the aggravating factor my client agreed to was the multiple victims, and that was the basis of a potential aggravated sentence, yes.
And maybe you could also address the argument that post-Fleming, or I should put it differently, the argument that the Fleming case and the statutory changes in some way abrogate or change what had been settled law from Dillon and Williams about what you can rely on for purposes of a departure.
So I think Fleming was in response to, actually, it was a case I had where a guy was convicted of multiple offenses, and they wanted to use an element of one of the offenses that could not be sentenced as a departure ground. And so I don't think those Fleming and that statute really impact what's going on here, because here we're double dipping on the or maybe triple dipping on whether there were multiple victims as, again, a basis to rank the offense as a RICO violation as an aggravating factor. I don't think Fleming is in play here on that issue.
Thank you.
And if there are no additional questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you both, counsel. It was very well briefed and very well argued. We appreciate that. We will be issuing an order within statutory time frame. That is the last case on our oral calendar. So with that, we are adjourned.